I see what you mean now when we had our mix-up last time about the what could have been trope in this special and like the Megamorphs book, and then having this one immediately after, which serves a similar kind of trope up to us.
Yeah, that was not one of my favorite of the time travel or timeline bending, I guess is more accurate for Animorphs books that we've had. And I didn't think it was a very good Jake book either.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know. Did you think that the Jake voice was effectively Jakey? Jacobin?
I felt like it was of two Jakes, kind of, which I suppose could be seen as fitting, given that the cover is literally two Jakes. One Jake morphing into another Jake. Yeah, I guess I'm not convinced, because there was, like, Mr. Responsibility Jake, and then also, like, my friends are more important to me than anything Jake, which I guess is the choice that's delineated in the end that they don't really give you an answer to, which, you know, it's great that we've been talking for, like, 30 seconds and we're just jumping right to the last page.
Well, I think part of what it sort of like shoots itself in the foot, because I am interested in the tension between like Jake as a leader and Jake as a friend. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really, you know, obviously that's a mounting question as the series gets on, but it's one that should be addressed in the real timeline, not in some future, some apocalyptic, terrible future where you naturally feel that the stakes are lower because you know that something is going to happen at the end, because obviously Jake cannot have aged 10 years, like, overnight.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it ended up feeling like simultaneously one of the, like, one-off Monster of the Week books, but also a myth arc book, and then doesn't really nail either.
That is a good point. I think, like, it definitely stands to reason that if you want us to take that dilemma or tension seriously, then like maybe put it in like reality, because they framed it in reality in the beginning. In the actual timeline that we're in, they're like besieging a building that I guess is going to be like a New York pool or something. I don't remember, but all you need to know is that they're besieging it, and they're like basically losing, and like Jake gets like his entrails like spilled out by a Horpager, and like he's basically calling a retreat, and Rachel is refusing to leave. Marco is trying to like pull her away, and there's like a door, Titanic coal room style, that's going down, and Marco and Rachel may not get out, and Jake basically says like leave them, and Cassie is flipping out about that. And they're able to get out from, like, they put a bar there or something. And Cassie gets really upset because she, like, killed 7 Horpager or something. Like, they do make a point to, like, illustrate how bloody and sort of murderous the body count, I guess. The reality of fighting with your teeth as an animal. And Jake sort of numbs out and
he doesn't perform his leadership role post battle in a way that the other Animorphs find adequate, I don't think, because each of them kind of loses it in the barn and sort of like during the debrief. And he just like is suddenly, and not really suddenly, because obviously this has been piling up, but he doesn't cope with any of them, and especially like they emphasize that he doesn't deal with Cassie the way that she needs to be dealt with. So, which of course has an added emotional layer because they're in love.
They're in like.
Right? Like.
Which is love, obviously.
That is code for love if you were a teen.
Circa 1999. Exactly. Yeah, they definitely zeroed in on Cassie needing to like talk it out. And it's interesting to think of like the other Animorphs as entities for Jake to handle. And that kind of goes back to like his leadership position as a leader and then like as a friend and like how is he handling each of his, comrades? Is he handling them as a leader of like a rebellion group, or is he handling them as like friends, like people? And he doesn't really do either. Although I guess it begs the question, can you do both at the same time? Is it possible?
Right, is he going to have to choose at some point whether he's going to be Marco's best friend or if he's going to be Marco's general, which is horrible.
Yeah. But it's also, I mean, that's also the choice on page, 149 or whatever. Like that's the final choice that they don't show us. I was glad though that they kind of leaned into the fact that it was not a straight up alternate timeline or anything. Like somebody was messing with Jake, like, and you got that impression because he was having like nightmares within nightmares within nightmares, or like hallucinations within hallucinations, and like there were weird coincidences, like his dad showed up.
And the glitch, it's kind of like a Matrix glitch when Marco refers to himself as Visser 3 and Jake's like, but you were Visser 2. Like, so
Yeah.
is this a simulation? Like, what is happening? And that's not really answered at the end,
Not at
unfortunately.
all.
It's like established that it's not the Elemist or Cryak that's like screwing with him, it's something else. And I honestly don't remember if that's ever followed up on.
Me neither, but that's not a surprise.
Like, all right, how many like chess masters are there in the universe, and like what possible purpose can this serve? Because it's a kind of a repeat of what, book 7, the bear.
That was so long ago.
It was so long ago. But yeah, it picks up similar questions of the butterfly effect and whatnot. The future world is interesting.
Yes, we should talk about that. And then we should talk more about the entity that is puppet mastering this situation. Because you I actually we'll reverse them. We'll talk about the second thing first. Because I got like a very strong sense of like foreboding, not remembering if something came of this later. I was just like, there has to though, because it's such a like ominous. It felt like Jake was being tested for some sort of like future use by whatever this puppet master is that set this whole thing up. And it didn't feel, I mean, on the most basic level, it was a little bit It's a Wonderful Lifey, where like Jake has this whole, I'm sorry to invoke the
Sidebar, I
movie,
hate It's a Wonderful Life.
and not just because they denigrate librarians.
That, yeah, but also it's just like really creepy.
This book had a similar sort of like trajectory of like sort of like a sci-fi dystopian version of that, where like here's your life if you made a few decisions or if you continued on the path that you continued on. Like it sort of suggests to Jake that because he checked out, because he didn't ask Cassie how she was doing and attend to her emotional needs, and because he made all those decisions, that like everything was eventually going to culminate in this weird ass world that he's in now, 10 years down the line, and that like when he snaps out of this, that's like the emotional resolution of the book, is that he calls Cassie and asks like, "Are you okay?" And that's it. So it's very weird that like that's the emotional trajectory and like that's all it took.
It's a great moral of the story, kids. Boyfriends out there, conduct your emotional labor accordingly. You may save the world
Exactly.
just by being a good boyfriend.
Exactly.
No, I think, I mean, as corny as maybe the last line is, I guess it's supposed to be metaphorical for him not withdrawing and finding a way to balance like his emotional needs too, because we don't want Jake to turn into like an automaton that doesn't talk about how he's feeling and what he's experiencing and how the war is affecting him. And we certainly don't want Cassie to become the Cassie that is projected in the future.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, so in that way the ending is effective, whether or not the puppet master is
aiming for that.
My favorite gimmick. It's one that, thankfully, the series doesn't, like, deploy that often. But right in a row, like, it's weird to me, like you said, that Back to Before was immediately prior to this book. I'm like, it's the same, like, the same hinge.
Yeah. At the same time, it was very easy for me to be like, well, Jake is a very tired young man. Like,
he's tired.
Exactly. Like, it made sense to me that, like, in terms of, like, where everyone is emotionally in the whole arc of the series, that these two come back to back, given that, like, we are, and I don't know, maybe we say this every time, but we are at the, like, tipping point of, you know, everything starting to get really dark, where Rachel's starting to get past the point of no return. I feel like they're starting to foreshadow a lot more in a lot of these books that are in this area. And, like, because we are, you know, I mean, we're within 20 of the end. So, I mean, I assume K.A. was plotting out the old end game by this point.
I don't know if she's ever made a statement like J.K. Rowling did about always knowing how Harry Potter is going to end. But I don't necessarily believe that of J.K. Rowling, but I would believe it if K.A. Applegate said it. Like,
you know, I have trust issues about that, about creators being like, I knew how this was going. Like, Lost did a number on my soul, and then also Amy Sherman-Palladino being like, I know how Gilmore Girls is going to end, and then still doing it in the revival, even though, like, it didn't really fit anymore. It just makes me, like, I'm like, you guys, don't kill your darlings. Like, don't cleave to your original outlines.
Yeah, not letting characters grow in that way, or, like, I look a little askance at creators who either say that or do that in the case of Gilmore Girls. Like, after you had written all this down and talked about it with other people, surely somebody would have pointed something out.
Would that be a good idea? So we should talk about this future world. It's very interesting because it is very much set in New York City, like, very specifically, and very much in contrast to how everything up until now, you know, is set in any town, California, USA.
Yeah, the vague West Coast, as opposed to this very specific post-apocalyptic escape from New York, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the 90s meter for this book is a Limp Bizkit reference. And also the World Trade Center.
Yes, which made me flip to the front cover and be like, when was this published? Like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it was definitely weird to read. Because, yeah, that's like the immediate signifier. That's what tells Jake that he's in New York,
mm-hmm.
is that he sees the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm. Which,
and then later on, there's some other landmark that's like been demolished. And, you know, I don't remember which one, but one of the big ones.
Mm.
And it's described basically as, like, ground zero.
Yeah, well, they blow up a building. Like, the terrorist organization blows up a building in New York City in this book, like, which makes it really uncomfortable to read. And also, knowing as well that this book takes place, like, originally was written in, like, what, May 2000, and they're progressing into 10 years into the future, and the World Trade Center's there. And so it's just a very strange awareness when you're reading it now, being like, well, obviously this is not the 10 years in the future, because we know stuff that happened in 2001. But at the same time, it's like very, it's supposed to be, I don't know, it feels very alternate reality in different ways because of that, which, you know, is just coincidence. There's no way to know when you're writing this in May 2000. But Jake basically goes to sleep in his house after that battle. And he also, like, has sort of a near-miss with Tom, where, like, when he comes home from the battle, he's in, like, his spandex, like, biking uniform, and there's blood on him. And Tom sees him and comments on it, which that whole interaction just gave me, like, a very, like, deep sense of dread and uneasiness. Where it's, like, the fact that Jake lives under the same roof as, like, a controller...
Yeah, and then later on, like, it's established by more than one character, I think, that Tom kills him, like, in the timeline that he ends up in, or the timeline that he comes out of, rather.
Mm. Yeah, that
and
makes
the,
him just, like, how
like
did that, they pull
that's that
off?
The future, as opposed to the future that he's in, yeah.
Yeah, that's, yeah, so that they did a good job sort of setting that up in the precious little time in the beginning that we had, like, an actual reality to work with. So Jake goes to bed after that incident, and then he wakes up, and he's 10 years older. He's living in, like, a space pod with a just malfunctioning toilet, and he doesn't know where he is. He has some idea.
He thinks he's gone crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, like, they think he's in, like, he thinks he's in a padded cell.
Mm-hmm.
And he's, like, in a tower, and he looks out and sees, like, other buildings. But the buildings have sort of, like, he describes them kind of as, like, growths on them, that they're, like, parasitic additions, but, like, architectural additions to these buildings. He realizes, or we realize, or, you know, whatever, but he's basically 10 years in the future, as if the Yerkes had taken over. And he finds out later that it's set up that it's, like, the Yerkes took over, like, 3 weeks after that battle. That was the last thing he remembered. But so he is in this New York. He is supposedly an engineer, a planetary engineer, which feels weird.
Given that we know that he's not the best student.
Exactly. Yeah, but they thought he was a controller.
What he could become.
That's I mean, exactly. He could blossom.
He gave up on his hoop dreams. Yes, I probably didn't even notice when I was a kid, but as an adult, I'm like, really?
Yes.
Peter is an engineer?
I thought the same thing, and I guess maybe the Yerk that everyone assumed was in his head was supposed to be a scientist, because that was another thing in this book, is they blurred the line between controller and host, like, a lot in this book.
I have questions about where Essac actually is.
Oh.
Like, everybody refers to him by his Yerk controller's name. Where the hell is the Yerk? Like, because, you know, you're given to understand that Jake is not a host.
Mm-hmm.
And that people think he's acting oddly and, like, asking stupid questions or not knowing where the bus is or whatever it is.
Mm.
Because his host body is, like, acting up and giving the Yerk a hard time.
Yeah.
But it isn't, I mean, I want to know where Essac is.
It was confusing.
If there was ever an Essac.
Well, that's two things that I noticed about Essac. First of all, his number, like, I feel like the numbers of the Yerkes up until now have been 3-digit or, like, maybe 4-digit. Jake's Yerk was, like, a 6-digit number, because I was just like, how would you remember all the numbers to, like, call that Yerk? Like, how?
Yeah, like, you gotta give them a nickname.
Exactly.
Yeah, and, like, I think, I mean, the way that I understand Yerk hierarchy is that the lower the number, the, like, lower status the being is, because, like, Visser 1 is the highest ranking Visser.
Mm-hmm.
So if his number was that long, either he's, like, really low ranking, which he's a planetary engineer, and he's working on the big moon project, so obviously that's not true.
Mm.
Or there's just a huge number of them now.
That's probably the latter.
It would be the latter, since they have taken over the galaxy effectively, including the Endblade homeworld.
Yeah, that's bleak.
I was so annoyed that there was no axe.
That's a good point. They managed to get everyone else, like, in there. They got axe's body. We'll get to that.
Yeah. Like, you can't just drop these horrible things on me regarding the future selves of the Anwarps and then, like, not give me time with them, but having met Marco in the future, I would have been okay if I hadn't met him in the future.
Well, that's the thing, is we didn't actually have time with him. We had time with the Yerk in his head, who was, again, blending the line between controller and Yerk. They only referred to him as Marco. They never referred to him as Visser 2 or the Yerk in Marco's head. They only referred to him as Marco, and he was adopting the mannerisms of Marco to a certain degree, like trying to use Marco's sarcasm and humor. So they were blurring the line, and it made me uncomfortable.
So creepy.
And especially, too, knowing that these are, like, adults now, like, because that was the thing that, is, I think, an obvious question is, like, how did we get here? Like, and obviously, for someone like Marco, who was infested, like, the question is a little more simplistic. Like, well, he got here because he had a yerk in his head. But for someone like Cassie or Rachel that we meet, and even Tobias, like, we eventually do meet all three, and none of them are hosts, and all three of them are in a very different state than when we last saw them. And so, like, my brain was just scrambling to put together, like, how did they get from the point that we last knew them to now, especially with Cassie?
In a way, it's like, maybe part of my reading experience for this book was that, effectively, and this is a dumb thing to say about a series that is ghostwritten, but effectively, it's almost like fanfic.
Mm.
Like, obviously they had to, like, get an okay for, like, the plot they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if Cassie would be like that, even given an apocalyptic future.
As it went on, I started to be a little more convinced. But it was difficult to see. It was difficult to look at the Cassie we meet in the future, who is part of this, like, rebellion. So to give a little more a little more of the actual plot, Jake finds out that he basically plummets to, like, ground level of New York City that's been, like, abandoned, and he's, like, in Times Square, and Texans start attacking him, and there's a woman who, like, saves him his life. There's some recognition there, and it turns out to be Cassie. And Cassie is working with an organization called a movement called the EF, which is the something front? What is it? Evolutionist front. Thank you. And the idea is that it's Yerks and humans working together to, like, subvert the Yerk Empire. And you got the impression that there were a lot of, like, subgroups happening, which that part I thought was really interesting. Like, to me, it's really interesting to think, because, you know, we talk about the Yerks taking over the galaxy or the Andalite homeworld in a very finite fell swoop kind of way. But, like, Earth is huge, and, like, we only saw New York City, and part of me always just goes, like, well, how did they get, like, Europe, or, like, Asia, or Africa?
Yeah, it's like the Hunger Games.
Kind of. Like, what did you actually do? I feel like if the Yerks wanted to take over the planet, I feel like they'd have to be a little more global about it. But these books are written by an American in America, so, like, you know, and it's not the only piece of American media to suffer from this issue, so I'm willing to let it slide. But regardless, like, first Jake meets with a group of people that are, like, disabled in some way, or otherwise, like, quote unquote inferior in terms of, like, the ability of their bodies, because the Yerks want, like, bodies. They want strong bodies. And that's what they comment about Jake, is that he has a strong body, so he must not have a strong mind, because he's ended up basically in, like, this subway station. No, a theater? I don't remember. Subway station, maybe? With all of these, like, sort of dying, suffering, like people. But Cassie is not in that group. She's working in the, like, rebel group. And she's working with the Yerk in her head. And it's never clear. It's never clear if the Yerk is talking or if Cassie's talking. We just assume that Cassie's talking, and that always, because Cassie was not acting like the most herself that she could be, it made me wonder, like, is the Yerk actually talking and Jake's just being incredibly naive right now?
Yeah, and even if, like, the Yerk wasn't specifically in control, like, assuming that she was infested 3 weeks after their last battle in the past, mm-hmm. that means that she's been a host for a decade, and at some point, like, you're gonna start blending, kind of. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, it was stated that the evolutionist front's, like, goals was some kind of symbiosis,
mm-hmm.
rather than, like, a strict, like, which has been, you know, that's been referenced earlier in the series.
Well, with Cassie herself.
With generally involving Cassie. Like, that does scan.
That part, yeah. I was like, I can definitely see Cassie trying to, like, work with. I can also see, like, if the Yerk is the same Yerk that she was infested with straight away, I could see that she could have convinced that Yerk to work towards this goal, and the Yerk maybe had characteristics that rubbed off on Cassie as they sort of blended and became, like, one entity. this book, I know the point of this book was for it to be solely from Jake's point of view, but it would have been a lot more interesting if we had gotten to hear from everybody as if this were like a real thing, but because it wasn't a real thing.
This is one where I was like, this would probably work. I would be probably happier with it if it were like a Megamorphs. Where you could have all of the perspectives, but we just had one of those. So.
Exactly. It was very similar to this. the other thing that they pointed out about, and again, this is another one of those things, I think a point earlier that I was going to make about Essac was that they went out of their way for Jake to comment on everyone treating him like a controller, and then he sort of, it ends a chapter this way, in the middle of the action. The action starts immediately in the next chapter, but the chapter ends with him sort of saying, like, well, when people act as though you're a certain way or have a certain thing about you, then, like, you start to doubt, and you, like, if it's true or not. And, like, they just throw that out there.
Yeah, they just leave it there, and then the next chapter starts off without any kind of follow-up on that kind of bombshell statement for somebody who has to act at least like a controller to say. I'm like, am I supposed to believe that he does have a Yurikun's head and we just never talk to them?
That's
like a not the greatest conceit, but it's also like kind of like a galaxy brain scenario. You know, like, I don't know what to think.
Well, so that's one of those things that just gets thrown out there. And another thing that they threw out there was when Cassie was talking about, like, symbiosis, they talked about artificial hosts. Like, that's what they're trying to do, is, I guess, make, like, robots for the Yurks to infest.
Yeah, I was not super clear on that. And, like, interesting. I wouldn't have guessed an AI angle for this particular series, but now I want it.
Well, exactly. Like, that's the thing. You just drop that into a dialogue, and then we're like, but wait, I want to know more about that. And then they don't ever bring it up ever again.
Yeah, there was a lot about the world building of, like, future New York that I thought was really interesting, and clearly the author had thought about it.
Yeah.
Like, what it would mean for the Yurks to take over the Earth. Like, what would happen after that. But unfortunately, you know, it's a 120-page book. They don't have that much time.
Yeah.
And it has to be about Jake's emotional journey, which is fine, I guess. And important. Tell me more about the possible artificial hosts, guys.
Exactly. Well, because that's, like, I mean, there's always the inherent friction of, like, what are Yurks supposed to do? Like, not all Yurks are evil. Like, what are they supposed to do? And so, like, my brain, like, it'd be nice if there were a solution that didn't, like, subjugate a whole people to their, like, cruelty. Like, that would be great if we could get that.
Why didn't they ever build robots? They obviously have the technology.
That
they can go through space. Like, it can't be that hard to build AI if you've achieved spaceflight.
If Axe were here, he would be like, well, Andalites have made robots since, like, forever. Like,
except we don't know if that's true.
We don't know if that's true. I just don't assume
that's true. We've never seen robots in the Andalite books. Yeah, it's actually kind of a weird blind spot now that I'm thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a sci-fi series. And it was coming out at a time when
people love talking about Dolly.
A fair amount of, like, of AI movies.
Oh, it's cloning, not robots. Sorry.
That too, though. Well, I mean, that's like a whole other beautiful can of worms. But yeah, I mean, the late 90s were a big scientific, like, headlines in the news time when people were talking about the internet and AI and cloned creatures and all kinds of stuff that the Yurks would probably find really useful. So
no, it is a very good point. And, like, it is weird that it's just brought up and dropped, and it actually could be, like, a huge thing that play a part in this series if, you know, if the author wanted that, which, you know, it's a huge thing. So it would change the way this series, like, progress, and it would be a different series because of it. So I can understand, like, why not do that, but also, like, imagine.
Yeah, there's a lot that you could do with either of those concepts. And, I mean, it can't be more expensive to build a lot of artificial intelligence bodies than to go around subjugating entire planets. Like,
well, and plus, like, you could build a robot that could have a Candrona ray, like, built in. Like, it makes so much more sense. Like, you wouldn't need, like, You wouldn't need to turn the moon into a Candrona ray, which is what they're doing in this book.
Loved that plot point.
Which also just reminded me of It's a Wonderful Life, because I kept hearing Jimmy Stewart's voice in my head just going like, you want the moon? Like, and I was like, they do want the moon.
That was like maybe the most vintage sci-fi part of this. Is anybody doing anything to the moon? It's very like Twilight Zone. Or, you know, there are Russians on the moon, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so we find out through Cassie that their plan is to make the moon into a Candrona ray, which then made me just go like, well, are vampire, like, do the Yurks become like vampires then? Where then they go out at night to, like, feed on Candrona rays? And then, like...
That's a good question. It wasn't really established whether it would... Although I think I'm thinking of it as like a literally a sun, because Cassie refers to it as like a Candrona emitting sun. But the sun doesn't shine all the time.
True.
From Earth. So, and the moon is not always in the sky, depending on where you are on Earth. Like, you know, the moon will be full or it won't be full.
The science like, guys, is just a little sketchy on this.
Did you study the Earth's rotation? Do you have planetary engineers? Because it doesn't seem like you do.
Well, that's why, when they're all Jake, who was the subpar student.
Jake, who probably could not at this point in time tell you how seasons work.
Aw, Jacob.
Which, I say that with the greatest love, because as you can attest, it took me a very long time to understand time zones.
Yeah. A different zone of time. I'm trying to remember what Jason calls it in The Good Place.
Exactly. Clock I really think him way too hard.
So Cassie's plan, like, the plan of the resistance is to, well, first of all, they blew up a building. And then they also want to destroy the... whatever they're going to point at the moon to turn it into a Candrona sun? I don't know. Again, the science and technology is not checking out here. Is that
yeah,
right?
So she's very excited to hear that Jake has become a planetary engineer who's working on this Chrysler building project.
Naturally.
Because he can be a saboteur. Mm. And for whatever reason, like, that bothers him, and I didn't really understand why. I'm like, does seem like the obvious choice.
Well, so... two things here. We'll start with the tiny one. First of all, like, why did they choose the Chrysler building? It's not the tallest building. Like, it's got the aesthetic. Like, yes. Like, there are eagles on
it. I never really thought that Yurks cared for the aesthetic.
That's, like, well, that's true. Like, the Empire State Building is much more practical. It's much more utilitarian. Like, it doesn't look pretty. Like...
it's very brutal.
Exactly.
It's very Yurky, actually.
Exactly. No.
I mean...
only think that when I look at the Empire State Building. Well, they called it the Yurk Empire State Building. They just added the word Yurk to the game.
Yeah, I mean, it's what Visser III, God rest his soul, would do. He would pick the Empire State Building to fire his Candrona ray from, like, a good supervillain. Like, duh.
Yeah, I don't know why they choose the Chrysler Building. I don't get it. But regardless, that's, you know, neither here nor there. But the thing about Cassie being very opportunistic and very hyper-focused on a much larger goal and not getting bogged down in the minutia of, like, Dear Diary, I killed 8 Horcruxes today. Which,
Dear Diary, we blew up a building and it was full of people who weren't even combatants. Yeah.
Well, and Jake goes out of his way, like, he specifically calls her, like, a terrorist, for all intents and purposes, mm-hmm. and is, like, very not okay with that. And it's interesting. It's interesting. I don't know exactly, because later on, somebody calls him on those beliefs, and I don't remember who it is.
Is it Marco? I think it was Tobias.
Oh, yeah.
And... I think part of the thing about the future Cassie and Jake dynamic that bothered me wasn't necessarily that I thought that Cassie was acting out of character, because she's a controller, regardless of how that relationship actually shakes out, and because she's living in this particular world. But I just really, it really grates my cheese when, like, the hero has to, like, teach somebody how to be themselves again. Inevitably, it's somebody who probably has good reasons for acting the way they do. And so those, like, exchanges where he's like, this isn't you, Cassie! And you could see him, like, you know, shaking her in the big close-up in the film.
Yeah.
And no, also, I mean, this is just, it's like an echo of the beginning of the book when they were doing what they have to do. It's come up again and again that what happens when they kill Hork-Bajir is that they're killing Hork-Bajir and Yerkes, but they won't kill human controllers. They'll kill Hork-Bajir controllers, and, you know. So.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing conversation.
Yes. And the other thing about Cassie, so Cassie fills in Jake on, like, where everybody is. So, they all got captured, like, 3 weeks after that raid. Tom killed Jake, because he figured it out, and killed him. They captured everybody. Axe became an Andalite controller, and then was pivotal in capturing the whole Andalite homeworld. They killed Rachel on the spot, is what Cassie tells Jake. Tobias is like, she said he's anti-Yerk and leading a revolution himself, but she doesn't seem to say that they're doing it together. Really?
Yeah, that's a little odd to think about. Like, so yeah, my buddy from the good battle days, like, survived the hostile takeover, but we didn't hook up again and, like, try to pull our resources and our already extant guerrilla warfare knowledge.
Well, and so that's, like, the other thing, too, is that the way that Jake was sort of pulled through, so he... It's very, like, Ghost of Christmases Past, Present, and Future, but, like, if they didn't talk at all with each other. Because, like, it's clearly, like, Jake meets Cassie, meets with Marco. Granted, Marco is, because he's a controller, he's presented as, like, a villain in this timeline. But Cassie, Rachel, and Tobias are not. And he first meets with Cassie. Cassie tells him to go to the public library. And so he does. Oh, there's so much to talk about. He goes to, like, an event first, and he meets Rachel. Like, that happens before he goes into the weird tree place, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, we'll get to the tree place. So, he meets Rachel, who has, like, no legs, one arm? Like, is, like, brutally scarred and unrecognizable and, like, can't breathe properly. She's basically, like, the Forest Whitaker of Rogue One of, like...
Yes. She is Saw Gerrera, which makes a lot of sense, actually.
Right? So, before we met Rachel again, that was another thing that made me question, like... And again, like, maybe it's not worthwhile to question, like, how did Cassie become Cassie in this timeline, given that it's a complete fabrication by somebody who, like, is puppeting people. Like, yeah. But still, in trying to riddle that out, I was like, well, if Rachel died, I can see where Cassie would adopt some of Rachel's characteristics as, like, a way to carry the torch, kind of. But then Rachel turns out not to be dead. But there's no indication that Rachel and Cassie, and then subsequently Tobias, are all working together. They just sort of exist as, like, these, like, mystical bridge, like, gatekeepers that, like, interact with Jake as he's, like, being, like, propelled through these ridiculous, like, nightmare sequences that don't connect. Like, and because he goes into a hotel and he, like, is in a tunnel, and they're like, he's like, did Cassie send me? And they're like, probably. And he's like, but I just went through, like, a tunnel, and I'm here in this place with a tree. Like, I don't understand. And in the way that your dreams don't connect, where you just get from point A to point B without any connection between them, like, that's how a lot of his, like, hallucinations are happening.
I can't tell if it's just bad plotting or if, like, that is intentional, and the author's way smarter than me, because, like, it's effective in making him... obviously feel, like, really fragmented, and it makes sense if it is all just, like, a projection.
I mean, and I will say that
you're reading, it's like, this is, like, he's just being really reactive, he's just, like, experiencing stuff, and seeing people that we'd like him to see, but who apparently don't ever see each other.
Yeah, that's, I think there may be, like, an inherent... inevitable dissatisfaction with what this book is, because I appreciate that it's not constructed in a way where they're like, everything's normal and logical, and we're going to pull the rug out from underneath you at the end. And I appreciate that as it's happening, you're very aware as a reader that, like, crazy stuff is happening and that you're, it is obviously a dream or a simulation or something. Like, something is up. But at the same time, like, it is, that disorientation makes it a little bit harder to, like, engage with, I think. Because as I was reading it, I was like, intellectually, this is fascinating. But emotionally, I am, like, not quite in it as much. And I think it's just a natural, like, byproduct of what this book is setting out to do.
Yeah. I don't like the Christmas Carol, It's a Wonderful Life conceit. Like, I don't like it at all.
Tell me more.
So, like, obviously I'm biased because that is kind of what's happening. But I can't stand it when characters are tortured with their loved ones, but it's not really them.
Mm.
And I don't know, it really bothers me for some reason.
It also feels a little unoriginal to do that with Jake. I feel like I might be a little more lenient if it was, like, one of the quote-unquote secondary characters. But, like, given that Jake is the mainest of the characters, and that he also is the leader, and that he also, like, the idea of that the others have to be handled by him, kind of going back to what we were talking about in the beginning, and the idea that he, like, deploys them and, like, uses them for their strengths and weaknesses, and, like, when he sees Rachel, he's like, oh god, I did this to her. Like, because of that, it tilts into that, like, gross main character territory of, like, this isn't you, and, like, I'm learning a lesson that my, like, that these projections of the people in orbit around me are teaching me. And I feel like if it weren't the mainest character, but a supporting character, I'd be a little more willing to go along with that.
And, like, if we take each of the characters as they appear to him, as to be, like, the exact opposite of what he would want for them, then, like, in order to give him enough impetus to, like, change his ways, like, that's gross.
Yeah, that is gross.
It is, for a lot of reasons. Specifically, like, the depiction of Rachel.
Yeah.
And also, I'm not sure if that's what the author was going for, because out of all of them, sure, like, Jake would not want to see Cassie become, like, a warmonger or amoral or somebody who, quote-unquote, understands war the way that he does or the way that Rachel does. Like, it's been long established that he values her borderline pacifism.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't want to see Marco as a terrible, horrible, like, mock-up of himself, basically. Mm-hmm. And somebody who, according to Cassie, has done terrible things. And basically has fallen into what Marco's mother was subject to.
Mm.
And I guess you could say that he wouldn't want to see Rachel unable to physically be a warrior. Like, that has its own set of problems. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what Tobias is going for.
Tobias is just trippy. This whole thing is, like, a very Dolly-esque.
The Tobias sequence, I was like, I don't remember this. What is happening?
It reminded me of Conversations with Dead People, that Buffy episode where Tara appears to Willow in the library through Cassie, but it's, like, the first pretending to be Tara in Cassie's body, and it's, like, freaky. That's what it reminded me of, where, like, Jake goes into the New York Public Library, walks down, like, an interminable aisle of books, and then Tobias is sitting at a table, but it's not, you don't think it's Tobias at first, because you think it's Elfanger. And then you find out that Axe had morphed, or that Tobias had morphed Axe's body and stayed in it, which everyone needs therapy, but like
and then aged, like, in real time.
And then aged in real time as Axe, and that he just looks like Elfanger. And yeah, what are we supposed to make of that? Like,
I honestly don't know, because Tobias being, like, the last of the ghosts of Apocalypse.
The Grim Reaper of the trio.
I mean, it's definitely, like, the most mystical and weird of the scenarios and conversations that Jake encounters, but I really don't. And it kind of, I mean, it makes some sense that that's what Axe would do, and that he would think that was necessary either to, like, honor Axe after he's becomes a controller, or to more effectively fight perhaps? Although the morphing power, I think, has been established as, like, the one that you want. Tailblades are cool, but being able to turn into anything is way better.
Yeah. Well, but that made me wonder, like, if he... Is that a loophole? Or if he morphs an Andalite, does he morph a creature with morphing power? And then he just morphs everything from Andalite? Like...
Well, it's always been... I mean, it's always been the case that you have to acquire the power from the box. From the device, if you have one. But I always wondered, and I don't know if the series addresses this at any point, if you can reacquire the power, like, if you're a Nuthlet. Because, like, Tobias has done that, and he morphs from his hawk form, but if he stayed in human form, could he then reacquire it and then just be a human?
That, I mean, the box is, like, buried like, in how many Cassie's shots do you backyard. Get with this? Yeah, no, this is another very good point. Another potential loophole.
But yeah, the long story short, I don't exactly know what was going on with Tobias.
I could see Tobias. I don't know how it stacks up with, like, what the author was going for in terms of, like, what Cassie represents, what Rachel represents, and what Tobias represents, like, as a trio.
Yeah, I don't know what Jake wants for Tobias, actually, like, in their normal reality.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know.
What he would fear for him, if that's
what the
what each of them is supposed to do.
I don't know. I would think that... I don't know. I can see where Tobias would, you know, if Tobias were, like, I guess, an entity with free will in this simulation. But I could see where Tobias would morph an Andalite to, like, honor, like, his real identity, quote-unquote. As, like, part of that family. And having lost both Elfanger and Axe, being like, well, this is... Which is an interesting shift. Like, again, if this were a real thing, like, is an interesting shift from, like, Tobias... You know, we've talked about sort of the suggestion that he is, wanted on some level to become a hawk. Like, he stayed in the morph, like, long enough, and that he's actually okay with that identity. And then the idea of, like, shifting again into the, like, body that best, like, fits what he, like, wants for himself. But that, yeah, I don't know what that has anything to do with Jake's perception of the situation. Or the puppet masters.
I don't know. That was the part that didn't work the most, I think. And especially because it's sort of like a twofer.
Mm.
Like, no, I want the real Axe. Tell me about the real Axe. Even if I have to see him as a horrible controller who subjugated his homeworld, like, show him to me.
Yeah.
Don't just, like, glom him and Tobias together into one mega Animorph.
What did... Tobias... Okay, Tobias lays out the choice. So Cassie is, like, telling him that they need to blow up the moon ray. And then Rachel is also telling him that, basically, I think. Like, and then, Rachel's imperative is what leads him to the tree people. Because she says, like, lose the people that are tailing you. And when he does, he cuts through a, like... sports store and ends up in a tunnel and winds up in the tree place, which I promise we will get to. But before we do, Tobias is the one that lays it out that he has to choose between Cassie or the moon ray.
Like, it's Cassie or the moon.
Like, exactly. Like, you can't have both. You've got to pick. It's Cassie or the moon. You want the moon? Too bad. You can't have Cassie then. So yeah, so that's a weird thing for Tobias's role in this. The whole thing is odd, and I don't know if we're just trying to make sense of something that, like, is meant to be the most enigmatic it possibly could be, or the most disorienting it could possibly be, regardless of, like, what would make sense. But, like, let's talk about the tree place. So, Rachel tells Jake to lose whoever's tailing him, those, like, weird translucent beings. Jake goes into a sports store, ends up in a tunnel, and then he comes out in just, like, a utopian kind of hideaway. It reminded me of, like, the metaphysical version of, like, the Hork-Bajir colony, where it's, like, hidden away in the mountains, and it represents, like, the possibility of hope as the planet moves forward, because it's all of the kids that they've saved from the Yurks, like, breeding program, basically. Because kids are useless to them, and so the kids are basically kept as, like, you look suspicious that kids could potentially be useful to the Yurks.
You know, I was, another thing about the world building, and the author's choices that intrigued me, because wouldn't you want to infest hosts as early as humanly possible?
That is a good question. You would think, yes, but then I guess what do you do with all those Yurk bodies? Those little baby Yurk bodies where their skulls aren't completely formed yet, and they...
Yeah, I guess it might be an actual physical limitation where, like, the ear canal just won't permit it.
Mm.
But if that wasn't the case, like, and if I were a Yurk, and if
yes,
I were in charge of making decisions for subjugating a populace...
Mm-hmm.
Yes, take control of the children as soon as you can. And, like, it's established that they do. They, like, basically keep them in camps.
Yeah.
And, like, they don't educate them, and they basically just, like, feed them.
They muscle them up.
Yeah, they get them all muscly. Although it's absurd to me to think that, like, if on the one hand you need planetary engineers, like, really? The Yurk is doing all the work?
Yeah.
Is that even... A brain that is atrophied cannot be of use, yes?
True. And also, like, it does beg to reason, like, obviously, taxons are good for, like, you know, chaotic destruction centipedes. And, like,
they are chaotic evil.
They are chaotic evil. And Hork-Bajir are, like, good for slicing and dicing. Like, Hork-Bajir are, like, meant to be warriors. Like, you can look at a Hork-Bajir and think, like, I know what a Yurk could do with that. Like, but, like, humans... They talk all the time about how you can just knock them right over, and, like, we're very fleshy. We have no, like, natural defenses. And so it does sort of beg, like, the main reason they always say that Yurks want to take over Earth is because there's so many of us. But
even then, like, you have to assume that somebody at Yurk High Command is, like, thinking a little bit.
I would
and
hope.
Thinking creatively. If you were going to pick a good thing or a useful thing about a human, hands are pretty good.
True.
Hands are okay. Like, hands are nice. Yeah. I like them.
Got a thumb.
They work well.
It's pretty good.
Walking upright, despite what the Andalites think, is spectacular, and we're very good at it. And, you know, like, creativity or ingenuity is usually considered useful in a species.
Well, it's...
And, like, the establishing of, like, these, the way that the children are raised as, like, they don't have any fun.
Mm.
They, you know, aren't permitted to play. Presumably they aren't permitted to have any kind of physical interactions with each other. You know, all those normal childhood development things are, like, somehow beaten out of them. Maybe real, like, literally. I don't know. You know what it reminds me of?
What?
The part in The Handmaid's Tale where Red talks about pig balls.
Okay.
If you want to fatten up a pig and also have it taste good, you have to let it do something.
Mm.
And so you give it a ball to play with. And I think that's been, like, established of most livestock, that if you let them, like, play or do something that isn't just, like, be trapped in a 5x5 until they're killed, that they will taste better. Which is a very mercenary, weird thing to say. You want your humans to taste good, yes? You want them to be as useful to you as possible.
Well, that's the thing, but it makes me wonder, like, what is the Yurk's endgame? Like, obviously, because where we are in the story now, it's just to take over Earth and have, like, a place to set up camp. But then, like, in this timeline, or this time stretch, when they're more advanced, they've got most everybody. Obviously, there are some exceptions. They're, you know, the EF, but even those people, a lot of them are controllers. Whatever Tobias is leading, they're not. Like, what did the Yurks plan on doing? Like, what is Yurk society? Like, what is your normalcy when they're like, oh, we've got a people now, we're not trying to get more people? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, like, is Earth now a center of, like, Yurk art and culture?
Yes, exactly. That's what
are they
I'm
making
kind
their own
wondering.
Music, or are they,
like,
just listening to however human music develops
or...
post, which I probably badly.
Yeah, like, what is the Great Yurk Age, where, like, the civilization is flourishing now that there aren't any threats from, like, outside invaders?
Right. Presumably they're at a plateau right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they have an entire planet. How many people are currently on Earth?
I don't know. Billions.
7 billion, we'll say.
Sure.
Because I don't remember.
Sounds good to me.
And they have the Andalite homeworld, which means they have a real plethora of different types of host species.
Mm-hmm.
Like, obviously, if your goal is subjugation, then you are going to stamp out culture and stuff. That was kind of why the detail of the library didn't quite land for me.
Because
It's established that when Jake goes into the New York Public Library, like the big one, that the books are all still there.
Yeah.
Like, even if they hadn't been looted or burned for warmth, probably, during an apocalyptic event in which humanity was going bonkers, the Yurks would have removed them so that nobody could get them.
Mm-hmm.
And read and teach their kids how to read.
Unless, like, they forgot what books are. Because it's like old technology.
Yeah, but is it Elfanger or Axe? It's Axe who's like, you know, you guys invented the internet and books wrong, right? It's like, the internet is so slow. Which, to be fair, at the time it was very slow. And books are, like, much more effective in terms of how they communicate information.
That is true. You can't lose the data on a book.
So I don't know. I have some questions about the Yurks' methods.
That is, yeah, that is true. And they went out of their way to set something in like a theater also. Which, again, yeah, just made me go, which I guess that's their point, is that the Yurks don't care about arts and culture. So that's where the bastions of, like, rebellion are set up, is in the theater and in the library. Like,
places where you could reasonably assume the Yurks wouldn't go.
Exactly. The gays are taking over. This is like,
to avoid your ex by not going to the bars they like. The tree people reminded me of that episode of Wishbone for the Time Machine.
I don't remember that one, but I love that that's what it reminds you of.
I had a very vivid flashback to that episode. And, like, the Morlocks versus the whatever the above ground lazy people are called.
I do not remember, but I love that that's what your brain went to. The tree people were, I mean, a little creepy, I'm not gonna lie. I guess, like, it's good to have hope and everything, but they're, like, all these children named Justice and Liberty and Storm.
Storm. I like to think that that person was just a big X-Men fan.
I agree. That is my headcanon.
I'm like, these children all have serious concept names, and this guy really likes Chris Claremont.
Yeah, I choose to believe that. But, like, Jake goes, and this kid named Justice is like, I'm going to fight all of the Yurks, and I'm going to save my friends that I, like, grew up with, but then I got rescued. And then Jake sort of, again, delineating this choice that Tobias is about to lay out to him, that's the ultimate choice in the last page, which is like, well, what about all the people that aren't your friends that are still in danger and still need saving? And Justice is like, nah, I'm gonna save my friends first. And then that's still what Jake, like, kind of does, like, or thinks he wants to do. Like, he doesn't want to just save the whole planet. He wants to save Cassie. And like you said, like, it's, because I think also at some point they use the word rescue talking about her. And I don't know if Jake says it about Cassie or if Cassie says it about Jake. But either way, it does very much smack of what you're talking about, where it's like, oh, that's gross. Like, the idea that, like, is he saving her, or is he saving, like, his perception of who he wants her to be in his mind, which is the gross part.
Right. Like, nobody wants to think that their friend and girlfriend is going to turn into somebody that they couldn't love.
Mm.
But, like, that's a Jake problem.
This is who she is now. Get to step in Jake. Well, and also, like, again, it's not like Cassie is fighting for the Yurks. Like, okay, yes, she's gotten a little more cavalier about the body count. But, like, it's war, dude. I don't know. That's always the discussion. That's always the hard thing. And she's been at it 10 years.
Like, the great tragedy here is that your best friend became a war criminal.
That is probably, yeah, that's the great tragedy, really.
Please care about Marco a little bit.
Yeah. No, it's true. And also, like, a little part of me was like, what does he think he and the Animorphs are to the Yerks, if not a terrorist organization.
Yeah, you're a terrorist cell. You're terrorists, guys.
Like, it's a matter of perspective. So in the end, the, like, Mylar-covered Chrysler building tries to fire up the moon ray. That's the most absurd sentence.
The moon will not be joining the Yerks coalition, by the way.
What are you going to do without the tides, the Yerks? What are they going to do about the tides? How is that their plan?
This is bad science, and it's probably because you have Jake as a planetary engineer.
Exactly.
It's never been suggested that science was a strong point.
No. I don't know who of the children would be the scienciest, but it's not Jacob.
None of them really seem super into school, which is fair, because they have other extracurriculars to worry about.
True.
But even before that, like, I think it was established that Rachel is a good student, because she's Rachel.
Exactly.
And that...
My favorite trope.
You can Marco... Marco was good at bullshitting papers, which is a great skill to have, and Jake was not. Kathy's good at emergency surgery, which probably serves her well in her future.
That is true. Well, and in turn, like, let me not fall into the trap of quote unquote hard science versus soft science. But Cassie obviously is the most sciencey of all of them, really.
She's an anthropologist.
Exactly. And like biology.
And a vet, yeah.
And I don't know, zoology, marine science.
But yeah, honestly though, fucking with the moon is a bad choice.
You're gonna destroy the whole planet you worked so hard to take over, you ding dongs.
Like, what do you? You might be making it easier for Yerks to feed on Kandrona rays, but you're making it much more difficult for their host bodies to live.
You'd think they would think about that.
This is the biggest loophole in the projection. Like, somebody's putting together a shoddy projection behind the scenes.
Kind of. Well, whoever this guy is. So yeah, so that's how it ends, is Cassie and Jake both end up on the Chrysler building. Cassie's like, destroy the moon ray. Jake's like, I want to save you. And then he's like, I know what I had to do. And then he lunges for either Cassie or the moon ray. We don't know which. And then the, like, projector reel stops. And it's like, surprise, like, lights on. Like, this is all we've got for today. And then he interacts with some sort of caps lock higher being.
The caps lock higher being is like, interesting choice. And like, you didn't tell me what the choice was.
Yeah.
This cop out.
Yeah, and one says it was not the Elemist. And then that's the other thing that makes it seem like it's a test. It says they have strangely segmented minds, conscious, unconscious, and an ability to reconcile both. They will bear more study, these humans. That's it. And so it's just like, well, something has to come of this. Also, shout out to the fact that Jake has a Star Wars Episode 1 poster on his wall.
I read that and was like, oh, baby, I also had a Star Wars Episode 1 poster.
Because
I didn't know any better.
I had a Ricky Martin poster on my wall because I also did not know any better.
I remember that.
Another brief little shout out that I want to make about this book is when Jake, because they say that, like, when Jake, he's supposed to report, you know, based on the color of his jumpsuit to his planetary engineering base or whatever, and he doesn't. He goes and has his, like, ground level nightmare adventure, and he says like, oh, like I went to the clinic because my human host was like acting up, and they're like, oh yeah, they have like pills for that, and so that's what you get at the clinic. But I really, really loved when he was chatting with one of the Yerks, who was like, oh yeah, like my host was a member of the ACLU and like he won't shut up about how I'm infringing on his rights.
It reminded me of my favorite Megamorphs, which is the Time Matrix one, and how John Barryman, the host, wouldn't stop reciting Henry V. So beautiful, gentle listeners, I would like you to tweet at us or go to the Tumblr inbox and tell us how you would annoy a Yerk if you were a human controller.
Oh, man.
Would it be, I don't know, Backstreet Boy lyrics?
I was thinking Spice Girls lyrics.
Because I know all of them still.
Yeah, I feel like it would be, yeah, some sort of, like, embarrassing pop music that, like, at the same time, I feel like that would be how, it would have a double-edged sword. Like, I would want to choose something that would allow me to cling to my humanity, to, like, and that would be something, like, that brought me joy and needlessly, but that would annoy someone else. So anything that I enjoyed from the ages of, like, 11 to 14, I feel like is prime.
Oh, I need a yurk. Finally, somebody to listen to me talk about horse racing who can't go away. You'd be trapped, buddy.
Oh, man. Yeah, this is a good, this is an interesting take.
Shout out to ACLU, you, buddy. That was topical.
I really, yeah, that felt right in my soul.
I think my favorite part of Jake interacting with, like, his workplace was the tacos. Apparently the Yurks have not mastered making good tacos.
That was another, like, great.
And then I think random. He's, like, talking to, like, an orf or something, and, like, the alien agrees with him. He's like, yeah, the tacos stink. Like, please get some more salsa.
Because he's, like, bluffing as he meets Rachel in the kitchen, and he can't see Rachel because Rachel's in a wheelchair, and, like, I guess the counter is too high. And so Jake bluffs and says, like, I'm just here to get more salsa. And the orf is like, yeah, you should. The tacos are bad. And then he goes to, like, get in a taxi and is like, never mind, I want more tacos, and goes back. And, like, that's his excuse. Like, why did you try to get into a taxi then? Like, you weirdo. Like, I don't understand what that ruse is. Because if they talk to that taxi driver, they're going to be like, yeah, he said he wanted more tacos and just got out.
The one with the tacos.
What a weird book.
A very weird book.
Yeah, honestly, there's really not a lot to, like, take away from it. Like, I enjoy talking about all of the weird things and what they could mean or why they were chosen. But, like, in terms of bottom lines or takeaways, I don't feel like we'll see, I guess.
Yeah, we certainly will. If Caps Lock Buddy ever comes back, don't recall that.
Me neither. Our listeners probably do and are mocking us right now with their... Actually, I did hear some of that. I don't remember if it's a Twitter or Tumblr post going around that was, like, the closest feeling to, like, being a ghost is, like, when people on a podcast talk about something that you know that they don't remember, like, what it is, and you're, like, yelling at the podcast, like, like, obviously can't hear you. That might be happening right now.
Yes, the fruitless occasionals of modernity.
So with that, we never really did an intro for this, but that's fine. This book didn't need an intro. It just, we just dropped us right in.
Finding a song for it.
Yeah, I'm not sure what kind of song for this.
Not a girl, not yet a woman. I mean, there's a certain weirdness to the cover. The cover really kind of messed with me, honestly. Because it's Jake, as you say, it's Jake turning into Jake.
That is true.
I don't know. It's just, for some reason, it, like, I stared at it and was like, at first I was trying to figure out, like, who I thought that older Jake looks like, and I didn't come up with anything. Okay. Like, 90s. Although he looks like he would be on, like, a late 90s show, like, Party of Five.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, non-specific 90s boy or throb.
It also says five on his jumpsuit. That's neither here nor there. But we hope you enjoyed talking about all of these questions in Animorphs 41, The Familiar. Even the tagline, they're out of sight, you're out of mind. What a weird book. Next time, join us for number 42, The Journey, which looks to be Rachel morphing an elephant, which has been one of her signature morphs for a long time now, but we're just now putting it on a book cover. So we hope you join us for that, and we'll be back to talk about it with you. I'm not a girl.